to welcome you to this series of two lectures. Our lecturer is Dr. Christer Stendahl of Harvard University, well known to you all. Certain facts about Dr. Stendahl you will find printed in your brochure, and I won't rehearse them at this time. His work is well known to us, perhaps best of all for his book on the Dead Sea Scrolls and his work as editor of the Harvard Theological Review. But Dr. Stendahl is not only an exegete. He has been active in other areas of the church's life as well. He is an ordained priest of the Church of Sweden and has done extensive work in the area of youth work. Another interest of his is liturgics and the worship of the church. At present, he serves on the Commission of Worship of the Lutheran Church in America. It is in this field, the general area of worship, that Dr. Stendahl will address us this evening. His topic is concerns the spiritual life of seminarians as it relates to all the facets of our life. With that, I am happy and honored to introduce our speaker for this year's series of theological lectures, Dr. Christer Stendahl.
Been given to believe that the Lyceum really is for the broadening of the cultural aspects of the life of the seminary, while I understood that the faculty takes care of the rest. This strikes me as a somewhat odd division, but I feel very happy to be placed in this glorious situation. I want to speak about renewal through liturgy as a catchword for what I have to say on the spiritual life of seminarians. Before I speak about this, I would like to warn myself and you about that danger which always appears when one speaks on a topic about the spiritual life, and that is that somehow the speaker has a tendency to sound much more pious and much more spiritual than he actually is in his own life. And yet, I don't see any reason why we should set the ideals and the conception of the spiritual life any lower than I will try to do today. Was it Chrysostom who pointed out, as many others have, that it would certainly be a miracle if a priest could be saved? There are many reasons why the minister, the professional of the church, is in serious spiritual danger. And I have found that the chief risk lies in the fact that one's spiritual life easily becomes so totally absorbed in one's ministry, so that sometimes one wonders whether there would be any spiritual life at all were it not for the fact that one was a pastor or a minister. That if one deduced and took away that part of one's spiritual life which is directly channeled and related to preparing sermons and doing this and doing that in one's duties in the church, one wonders what would remain. To that extent that one wonders whether one would be a Christian if one were a layman. This kind of professionalization is one of the greatest risks of the ministerial life. It eats itself into every segment and into every cell of the minister and the pastor and the priest. His reading of the scriptures is constantly under the pressure of good thoughts for sermons, good arguments for apologetics. There is a pragmatic curse over his spiritual life which finally both drains the spiritual life and makes him an unusually uninteresting and unattractive person. You have all heard, I guess, the story about the two German pastors who were climbing the mountain, and one of them had a little heart condition, so he didn't take so well for the height. So he almost didn't make it, but the younger friend pulled him up the last piece so that he could come up on the summit and see the beautiful scenery. But instead of looking at the scenery, the parson said, "Ach, das kann homiletisch ausgenutzt werden. That can be made use of in a sermon." Now, this kind, which is a ridiculous example of a very serious professional disease amongst us, has to be faced head on. Not to be able to read a novel as one should read it, to see a movie as one should see it, to see a flower as God wanted it to be seen, but constantly hunting material for one's professional ministry is a curse. And it applies to also deeper levels of the spiritual life. This is my first point, then, that it is very important for the seminarist, from the beginning of his seminary studies, to see to it that there is a private chapel in the cathedral of his life, a private chapel which somehow is lifted out of the pressures of the pragmatic, which somehow is lifted out of the pressure of the cheap and easy relevancy, which both the world and the church is so hungry for, a place for the spiritual life of the soul, and not the mouth and not the brain and not the loudspeaker aspect of the ministry. I think much too little attention has been given to this in our tradition. And I think that I would even stick my neck out and say that field work, as usually handled in our seminaries, is a very serious threat to this need. I'm a firm believer in the internship, with all its strictures and the total being plunged into the situation of the church on a 24-hour a day-night basis, around the clock and around the year. But field work, at least for juniors, destroys from the very beginning very easily that sort of need which the theological student, which the seminarian has to find himself before God and find God. And if one just sweats all these wonders out into activities, if the pressure of problem as well as of grace which builds up over the week has to be sort of, that pressure has to be alleviated in little squirts of activities every weekend, this over-professionalization takes place in a seminarian's life even at the point when he doesn't have enough to profess. Therefore, one has to watch, and one has to find, with or without the help of the administration, the framework within which the soul can grow. I'll speak a little more tomorrow about how I think about the relation between the academic and the devotional, or the academic and the ecclesiastical, or the academic and the confession of faith in relation to the scriptures. But I think it is very clear that good teaching as such, good teaching as such, does not automatically, just because it happens within seminary walls, nurture the souls of men. I would even argue that if it is real good teaching, there shouldn't be too much direct, digestible food for the soul in it. And the teacher who becomes too concerned about that is really not usually doing his job right. But let's leave that to tomorrow, and rather go on to my second point, which would be something which has been rather alien to Protestantism, and yet I think is of the necessity to face, and that is the special needs for the clergy and the seminarians in the realm of the spiritual life and of worship. One of the glories and one of the plagues of the Protestant tradition, without those special laboratories called monasteries and the like, one of the glories and one of the plagues has been that we, by and large, in our tradition, know only one type of pastor, the one who knows everything and nothing, one kind of church, which is supposed to be everything to all men, but therefore very often is very little to most, a lack of recognition of the special needs for special men. I remember when I was appointed chaplain to the students at the University of Uppsala, the Archbishop, then Archbishop of Uppsala, Adam, was a very kind man, but a very stubborn thinker. We used to take, after chapel, when I had a chaplain in the cathedral, he always took a walk with the one who had been in charge of the chapel. And his only concern was that I shouldn't do too much work among the students. Now, of course, I could counsel with them and I could be nice to them, but I shouldn't, for heaven's sake, arrange anything for them, because there was something unchristian in the idea of being set aside as a chaplain to students. There were only one kind of humankind, and that was just plain Lutheran sinners. And any kind of distinction in this massa perditionis, or hopefully something else, was alien to the Lutheran and the Christian understanding of the gospel. So I guess I have been rather long in the battle for what you might call the specialized ministry. And yet, of course, in a romantic way, one has to agree with these people who don't like to see that there are special chartered buses to heaven, but we should all go on the big, whatever it is. Now, I think that it's very obvious that in view of the risks, the spiritual dangers, dangers of professionalization, dangers which I have spoken about, we have to recognize that the needs in the matter of worship, in the matter of daily devotion, in the matter of retreat, in the matter of meditation, in all these matters, there are special needs for the clergy and the seminary. And the sooner we face that, the better. Now, of course, there are always these high church boys around, as you know, in all seminaries, sort of spot them somehow. And they are very nice. And they have seen something. But you have always the feeling that their dream would be to turn the whole world into one big high church seminary. And that to me is a rather frightful thought. I think it is true that so much of the kind of piety and the kind of mood of worship which these men, to which I in many respects would line myself, have seen, experienced and profited from, belongs exactly in a situation as ours. Anyone who has been used to say, whatever you call it, the daily office or the breviary or something, and start to raise a family with kids at the age of 2 to 3, runs into certain difficulties of quite a practical nature, which somehow indicates that there are other aspects of the Christian life than those which can be handled in these honored forms. But in our setting, in a seminary setting, for the minister, we have to much more consciously say, these men need something special. I think it is right, and I would almost say it is good if you do not always get too much out of the parish worship. Because if you got a lot out of the parish worship, it wouldn't really be for the parishioners. Now that is to overstate the case.
And there are those mightily gifted pastors in God's church who manage somehow by a charisma to span the whole, but most of us can't. And a word directed to all is usually a word directed to nobody. It is as it should that the parish minister should spend his first years in the parish by unlearning that sort of theological shorthand, which one could call systematic theology, another theological discipline. A handy kind of shorthand as one plays the game,
but a useless kind of means of communication in the actual parish. But he who has gotten through theological training, his mind speeded up. He who can easily skip a couple of links in the argument, so to say, has to get pretty bored listening to the slow-paced and wisely slow-paced sermon. We need, especially in the ministry and among seminarians, and perhaps also in the church, some very strong ways of guarding against the chief sin of Lutheranism and Protestantism in general when it comes to matters of worship and matters of liturgy, and that is to translate the doctrine of the word into a magical faith in words, in a constant speaking, in a constant addressing the people, or whatever one addresses. Of course, this address stuff has gotten a certain revivification in modern biblical theology. We got this terrible word kerygma to play around with, the herald who announces things. And I've heard a lot of preachers who have started to shout a little more since they heard that they were now these sort of emissaries who were heralds. As if the Spirit came, not so much through the many words in this case as through the heavy emphasis. The doctrine of the word lies
considerably deeper than in an infatuation with the sermon as the means of salvation.
And the problem, especially when ministers meet together and when seminarians meet to worship together,
is to find a form
in which they can worship rather than study their own and one another's homiletics. And that isn't always easy in a Lutheran tradition. Here is where all means of meditation and retreats, and I mean real retreats, quiet retreats, and not sort of American stuff where as soon as you go out to a campsite in the woods where you freeze, you call it a retreat. The reason, of course, that these campsites are cheaper when fall comes around and nobody wants to go. We have all been through that. But a whole program, both in these forms and in the seminary itself, which in my judgment should be handled by what I would call chaplains, who in my judgment should not be members of the faculty, should not
have their duties assumed except in rare and special cases by the faculty,
spiritual guidance and counselors toward the classics of the Christian tradition, toward meditation, toward intercession, toward a pattern of a private
devotional life. And here we also need, of course,
something which the Roman Church have always been unconsciously
blessed with, I think.
Some of them here, so I have to be a little more careful. And that is a type of worship and a type of devotion
in which and with which it doesn't make any difference
whether you are few or many. I'm of course referring in a way to the daily office, to the breviary, in its different also Protestant forms. But I've sometimes wondered very, very simply and psychologically on what the idea of the sermon or the sermonette or the spoken meditation or the even read meditation of this kind has done to Protestant worship. And I have found that one of the real difficult things has been that it makes such a tremendous difference whether the church is filled or there are only two people. There is a vulnerability as to the very essence of worship
in the sermon-centered
tradition.
And we have to find
ways to overcome this. And this leads me to my third point, and the homiletical influence is heavy, so this presentation has only 3 points. Speak about the liturgy in the specific sense of service centered in the Lord's Supper. In the history of Christendom, in the history of Protestantism and in the history of Lutheranism, there has been very interesting periods in which one faithfully, very faithfully, sometimes not for the right reasons, but faithfully, stuck to the time-honored form of the liturgy with great formality and reverence, but somehow the genuine spiritual life found expressions which went by the side of the main service itself. I know of no church where that is as true as in my home church in Sweden, which is the most proper worship I know of in the world. It's proper because there are no risks of life at any point, as it is often carried out. Now, the striking thing with that properness is, of course, that all the genuine
forms of actual private worship were never channeled into the main official worship of the church.
I know a lot of people who consider it very, very Catholic or something to kneel in church, but they kneel at their bedside every morning and every evening
when they say their prayers. But they would consider it terrible to kneel in church. Now you can use that as a sort of symbol.
What it means when a tradition somehow freezes
into a proper traditionalism and formalism,
and the spiritual life somehow channels itself in many other directions. Now I know that this is true and has been true about all the Lutheran churches in the 18th and 19th century especially. And while one
has to
be grateful to the tenacity and the formal conservatism with which these people kept the treasure of the depositum fidei,
one has to be very, very critical of a state of affairs in which the main
service of the church,
in which the liturgy, in which the Eucharist,
is a museum
and a formal manifestation, but not the place
where the world and the individual Christian can feel the pulse
of the life of the church. For a seminarian,
if he is to be
a minister of the church, I shouldn't say that it is necessary, but I would say that it is.
No, why not say that it is necessary? That he somehow
finds in the liturgy of the church the
natural expression of his own life of worship.
Now I know that this is very rare. In very large segments of Protestantism.
I know that worship and that the liturgy is approached in many seminaries as something to be performed by the minister, and you train the minister to perform. You really do not train him to make this
his second nature. And here I am back again
to the danger
of too early
professionalization of young theological students. Personally, I've always felt that a theological student shouldn't do too much in the church anyway during his study. And this is because
he should
really have a chance with growing
theological insight and awareness
to see the church from where the laymen sit. To see the church from where the laymen sit at the same time as one has a growing theological insight is one of the most creative elements in a theological education.
But if you throw your lot in with a
ministry mentally, emotionally, attitude-wise, too early, something is lost. Or one could say young ordinands should be, it's a terrible image, but it's almost used in St. James' Epistle. Should be these sort of
horses
on the racetrack who are ready to go. But I know a lot of theological students, when they come to ordination, they have tried it all and they have been around the track so many times, so there is really no excitement in the situation at all. Now, the attitude toward the liturgy again,
which
holds the power of renewal in the church, if it becomes the life expression
The attitude toward death should first and primarily
be one of participation.
And it should not be adulterated
by looking at it
professionally at too early a point.
For what is the liturgy? One can describe it in many ways. And personally, I have been impressed with seeing the gathering of the church around the Lord's table as the true manifestation of the family of God. After all, although we had difficulties to remember that in the Lutheran tradition, because we fought a lot of misunderstandings in the medieval tradition, but we got so utterly conditioned by our fighting those bad situations back there,
so that we
got caught in the Middle
Ages ourselves, but the Middle Ages in reverse,
as you know.
It's not in Protestantism, which is that. It isn't really a liberation, it's just the Middle Ages.
It's in reverse. And I think that's better than the Middle Ages, of course, but doesn't really point forward. We should remember, in spite of all the discussions, that at the heart of the Lord's Supper, there is the messianic banquet, there is the meal, there is the family of God. Now the liturgy is a family affair. Any use of the liturgy for programmatic purposes, for
preaching to the outsiders, is really, in a way,
contrary to the essence of the liturgy.
The liturgy is a family affair.
And if there be foreigners, let them overhear
what the family of God is doing
and is about. Whom,
as you know,
is the place to which one goes when one has nothing
else to do. And that is the best
definition of a home I know. If you go home in order to
anything, then it isn't
really a home.
Then it is a place to sleep,
or a place to eat,
or a place to rest.
But a real home is the place where you go when you have nothing else to do. Then you go home.
And
the liturgy
is, in its very essence,
this home
of the people of God. It is in our liturgical life
that we are what we are.
Children of God. Any use
of the liturgy for secondary purposes falls short of this standard. To use the liturgy as a kind of filling station for spiritual power for the week to come is, by the grace of God, possible and profitable. But if it becomes the philosophy of liturgy,
the whole thing will wither. Any use of the liturgy as a framework for
a mighty evangelistic effort to the world is uncongenial, and that evangelistic effort has to find much more natural a form. I always liked the Salvation Army, both practically but especially theoretically, in its distinction
between what they call meetings for salvation and meetings for sanctification.
And the meetings for salvation start in the marketplace with soapbox witnessing and all, and this sort of little now outdated Beatle music, And
then you drag away to the, whatever it's called.
House. And then on Sunday you gather the faithful for a family affair. And there is something correct in this view of the structure of the early church and its preaching and its ministry. Now what I'm trying to say is actually
that especially for the minister
who is going to play a major role as a minister in the church, in these services,
and particularly in the liturgy itself, it is of the prime importance
that he has a grasp of the liturgy as his second nature, as the expression of his own spiritual life. And that expression
can only come
when he has seen the liturgy not as a speaking situation, not as a preaching situation, not as a pragmatically motivated situation of any kind, but as the gathering of the family of God, as the breaking of bread together, as the being at home and letting one's sinful hair down. That's a Lutheran touch to it. And an important one. Because with a certain state church heritage in Lutheranism, we have received an overly functionalistic view of the nature of the church. I always ask students and pastors and so forth, Lutherans, to quote the seventh article of Augsburg's Confession. And they all volunteer, because that's the only one they really know, you know. They always volunteer happily and hastily, and they say that the church is where the
word is rightly preached and the sacraments are rightly administered.
There is a little textual problem here, but it comes out roughly that way.
Question whether you read Latin or German.
A lot of people, perhaps even some who sit here, think that this is the right quotation. But what it actually says is that the church is the communio sanctorum in qua,
is the communion of the saints in which the word is preached and the sacraments administered.
But for some strange kind of reason, one has gotten so infatuated with the idea of the function, so that the communio doesn't seem to be as important, and in some quotations one can just as well let it go.
Because the essence lies in the preaching and in the sacrament. This sort of loudspeaker
theology with
canteen supplement is a ridiculous theology and a very dangerous ecclesiology, because the church is not a platform or a sounding board for these activities.
The church is the household of God. In this church,
we live by and under the word.
We are addressed, but we are also many other things. The church is a much broader reality in its total family life than expresses itself when the young seminarian thinks about himself as the preacher and the liturgy as the great background with time-honored language to his own crummy service.
And that situation can both be stifling and falsely glorifying
and get wrong in all kinds of directions. Because through all these three comments I have given, you could say perhaps that I am really expressing one of the basic insights of the Reformation, namely that what matters is what you are and not what you do. What matters is to find a way in which what one does in the ministry, or what one does within the liturgy, one being the seminarian and the minister, becomes swallowed up by the much more important question,
which is that
of being at home, of relaxing in grace. And this is the essence
of the liturgy, in which we even hum with the angels.
Such a view of the liturgy also has liturgical consequences.
And I've always thought that those Anglo
Catholics were very unfortunate,
because they
managed to copy Rome at an unusually bad period in the middle and late 19th century. And also liturgically so.
I'll never forget when I spent some time in England in 1951,
and I went to some high church churches in Cambridge, England, St. Giles, I guess it was, which was higher than the high.
And it was as these pictures I had seen of the Roman
Mass in those old books, you know, before they had photographs, you know, they had sort of drawings, and it all looked Gothic, you know, Gothic print and all that. And then I came to France, among the Dominicans and the Jesuits and the Benedictines, and I thought it was as these pictures I had seen of the Roman Mass in those old books, you know, before they had photographs, you know, they had sort of drawings, and it all looked Gothic, you know, Gothic print and all that. And then I came to France, among the Dominicans and the Jesuits and the Benedictines,
and I thought I had come to a prayer meeting when I came to the
That's perhaps overstated, although it is true in a deeper sense. But the point being
that here is really where, in the liturgical renewal, the separation goes between the men and the boys. Now the boys just try to be liturgical, but the men have caught a glimpse of this basic simplicity,
which is the very essence of all true liturgy. A simplicity which is so simple that there is at the heart of it the gathering of the family of God. It's very interesting to study liturgical movements in the world at large, and it's a worldwide phenomenon. And it almost always starts with a kind of historical romanticism and sort of getting more things, you know, paraphernalia of different kinds, and trying to hang sort of purple things in Lent on as many things as possible, and so forth. But that is just the first generation. And in the second generation, you have a much more basic grasp of the very simplicity and essence out from which a genuine growth can come. And this is also true about the way in which I think that the renewal of the church will come through the liturgy,
rightly absorbed in the spiritual life of the seminary.
Because here, and actually only here,
in this wicked world of ours, here in the liturgy, we are
what we really are in the eyes of God. Here, our being children of God becomes manifest in judgment and grace and in nurture. And unless the church finds that place in which she is, she will never be ready to do anything. It is true to say that there is a great crisis in the life of the church today, in spite of its spectacular statistics, which aren't so spectacular if you look at the population growth. Just saw a figure today where we have apparently passed the 190
million mark in our population, and Alaska didn't add that much. Now there is a great crisis which the clever people call a crisis of identity. There is a crisis of identity in the minister who doesn't really know what his role is, so he turns into the psychiatrist for those who can't afford a real one. Or he turns into something else. But there is a crisis of identity. And there is deep down a crisis of identity in the church itself.
And therefore there is no
just liturgical romanticism in saying that unless the church and in the spiritual life of its seminarians find that place in which it is, in which it abides in the hands of God, there is little hope that all our projects will save our soul. I think I'll stop. I think that here the common sentiment is basically right. That is to say, there was a period in the history also of Lutheranism
where one treated that which was in the service book or whatever you call it, in the hymnal,
as the sort of museum is too strong a word, but the proper form for public worship. But by somehow, the private spiritual life went around it and expressed itself in other ways. I think that with the elements of liturgical renewal, which have been stressed so much, not least at Valparaiso and these places, the tide has turned, that one has seen the possibility of both by instruction and practice channel what you might call the religious needs of the congregation into the general prayer of the service instead of having a special prayer service and so forth, and by one really can play with much less dignity in a way in that sterile sense and much more directness and simplicity within the framework of the liturgy. I think we are on the right way. Now, this is mainly a matter of education, emphasis, and very much a matter of how the minister, I was almost about to say, feels himself about the liturgy. And also that if he feels very strongly, he should, as Paul says, be all things to all men, in the sense of not just pushing his most recent ideas from Una Sancta upon his poor congregation, which makes him, of course, feel good, and if people get angry, he even feels as a martyr for the truth. But he should, as Paul says, practice agape, love, which means concern for the building up of the whole. But I don't know if that is that's a nice little speech, but I don't know if there's an answer to your question. I'm not too good at that. I think there are ways in which one can draw laymen into the actual liturgical practice and so forth. I think that the way in which one gives over parts of the general prayer to be proposed by the laity and so forth, all these things which break down the wall of partition between the chancel and the people is sound theology, and it would be awfully shameful if the Roman Catholics were the ones who were going to teach us this. But they actually are, at this very point. Never forget the demonstration mass I saw at Notre Dame last summer, which would make any liturgically proper person shiver in terms of course, what I also happen to like, but that is not in this point. I've recently made myself a proponent for the U language in liturgy. I don't think that we should have this Shakespeare plus kind of language. And being a foreigner, I always find that I shouldn't really have to take a course in Elizabethan English in order to speak it out. But I may have my biases here. But I think that these are general things. I don't think it helps just with more acolytes and so forth. I think we need primarily to draw people into this who are not just symbols of people, but people who also, in all other respects, really bear the burden of our common life in the church. There are other things to do than to usher.
Would you say that the taking of the bread, making it a special moment over against the regular most of the people during the week, and also bottling of the wine and sacramentally bottling it over against the regular wine that you use during the week, would be another communication of this, the more of the week?
I know that Hebert and others have written about this and practiced this, and the whole idea of the sacrament and the life of labor and so forth. Of course, it takes a mighty education program to get an average congregation to see the difference between the way it was done before and the way it is done now. I think that these are symbolic things one can use, and but of course, the enthusiasm which some people feel about these solutions is not commensurate with the
obscurity of the symbolism which they have to the outsider.
I think the best way to go about this is to start not with the seminarian in the seminary and sort of tell him, now these are the steps you go through. But I would, for one, bring him to a retreat in which you began with guided meditation, first guided step by step, then the kind of meditations in which
you gave certain outline and he went back to his room or he stayed in the chapel
together with others.
And then
sort of carry on this kind of
experience in his daily or weekly routine.
That is to say, I
think that you need
something more
than just say, do it this way. You need the supportive community, you need the break. Now, what it would contain, I have never become dogmatic about a pattern of meditation, mainly because it seems to me that to meditate on a parable of Jesus, or on the Passion narrative, or on a Pyrenaic part of Paul's epistle to the Romans, is really such a very different thing. When you meditate upon the Passion, the visual representation in your mind is so natural and is a part of it in itself. I'm not always so sure that it helps too much to visualize the parable. I guess I'm a little too much of a biblical scholar to feel that one should play that wildly into the hands of allegory, which would almost automatically come out if you sort of picture the parable affair. And again, to meditate upon this Pyrenaic material is a different thing. I'll speak a little about that tomorrow, about the relation between how the scripture, of which I here speak when I speak about meditation, I think exclusively about biblical meditation. How the scriptures function, so to say, in the academy and in the church. It seems to me that one of the rules of meditation is not to get cramped in the first instance. That is to say, meditation does not mean now I throw myself up in the spiritual realm so that I can look at these things spiritually. Meditation is more in line with a reading of the daily office, which I always feel is a little like taking off with an airplane, and it doesn't perhaps always take off either. It really taxes along to start with, but sometimes it takes off into what you might call, subjectively speaking, genuine prayer. And so it is also with meditation. I'm very struck by the old folks who were called readers. You know, the ones who really read the scriptures, they didn't have this kind of slot machine approach, giving 10 verses or a chapter to God in the morning to tell them some great insight or something. That's awfully neurotic and awfully cramped. They read the Bible, strangely enough, the real pious people read the Bible much more like another book than many people who try to read the Bible today do. And this is, meditation is really,
I think, to, in its very essence, to read, to picture, and to withhold the question, what does this mean for me, until the text itself or the account itself has come alive. And this is what is so hard for the preacher, because he's so afraid that he will not have a sermon on Sunday. So he just can't wait. And meditation is to wait. Now, I don't know if that is an answer. Is your question that I singled out fieldwork, but actually the professionalization permeates everything else at the seminary also?